My name is Karen Stickland, and I'm on staff here at Holden. I do general maintenance. I'm called a Maverick, and I'm the fire chief. Two responsibilities there. Tonight I'm going to tell you a little bit about my own story in relationship with the White Train. It's in relation also to the arms race, and I can't cover the whole history of the arms race or all the history of nonviolence, so I'm going to limit to my personal story, and which is the reason I passed out this sheet, so you could see some of the facts. I'll go briefly over some of those. There are other books, other reference books. One of them is Waging Peace by Jim Wallace. That's in the bookstore here, and it's, I think, a very good anthology. It has articles on economic aspects of the arms race, technical aspects, theological aspects. And we also have a lot of tapes in the tape library, some by Dan Erlander, and a lot of tapes by John Howard Yoder on the theology of peace and peacemaking. I want to start off by saying that I believe that all people want peace. And some people believe that the way to peace is through a strong defense and nuclear weapons. I don't believe that, but I still believe that those people want peace. And I think that's important for me to say because that's part of my own philosophy on peacemaking. And I also expect that there are different opinions in this room, and so at the end I'll try and leave some time for some questions and some comments that you might have. Since the title of my session is The White Train, I'll tell you a little bit about what the White Train is. It was first noticed by Jim Douglas about in December of 82. Jim Douglas is a co-founder of Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, and they do a lot of organizing around nuclear issues. They're based up in Bangor, Washington. The train has been going for about 20 years, but this was the first time that it was ever seen. And the White Train, leaves from Amarillo, Texas at the Pantex Corporation, where they manufacture nuclear warheads. And it goes terminates in Bangor, Washington, and it also goes to the East Coast. It goes to Bangor because there's a submarine base there where the Trident submarines are based. Right now there's the Ohio, the Michigan, and the Florida, three Trident subs. The train is white because it's carrying nuclear warheads, and they have to be maintained at an even temperature, and the white reflects the sun. It's also a heavily armored train. There are cars on each end of the train with gun turrets, and there are armored guards inside. And there's also Burlington Northern security when it arrives at Bangor, cars alongside of it, and generally pretty heavily armed. The sheet I passed out tells you a little bit about what the Trident submarine is. Like I said, I can't go over everything, but this is mostly derived from a book called First Strike, this book, by Robert Aldrich. This is a pretty technical book on the Pentagon's strategy for nuclear war. Robert Aldrich helped to design the Trident missile system, but he resigned from his job because of reasons of conscience, because he felt that the Pentagon was no longer trying to defend the country, but was developing a first strike policy. That is, the United States would fire the nuclear weapons first. One thing that helped to motivate me in my relationship and what I've done is the fact that one Trident submarine, has the destructive power of 2,000 Hiroshimas. And to me, that's almost unthinkable that we could be making submarines that would have that much destruction. And that's only one sub, and we already have three, and we want about 15. That doesn't include all the other defense systems that we have, defense systems, the MX missile or any of our intercontinental ballistic missiles, anything like that. So what I did was I learned about the facts about the Trident submarine. I read about the justifiable war theory. We as Christians have a history of justifying some wars if they follow certain criteria, and these are real well outlined in this book, By Faith Alone, A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb by Dan Erlander. And it's very simple and concise. Some of the things that must be present before a war is justifiable are that a war must be properly declared. Once the war is over, we must be able to give aid to those that are injured. We must not kill non-combatants, that is, civilians, indiscriminately. We must be able to discriminate. These are soldiers, these are civilians. And there must be some chance of resolving the conflict after the war is over. To me, reading the justifiable war theory, I can see no way that a nuclear war could ever be justifiable under these criteria. And there's no way that we can give aid to millions of people injured after a nuclear war. There's no way that we can discriminate between who's a civilian and who's a soldier. There's really no chance of resolving the conflict after the world ends. You know, that's kind of it. And I don't think we can properly declare a nuclear war, because we can strike the Soviet Union in about 10 minutes, and there's really no time to declare a war if we think that they're firing on us. Our response is to fire on them, and Congress is not going to have time to vote on it. So that, along with my understanding of the gospel, which is maybe a naive sort of reading, but I understand the gospel to say to me to turn the other cheek and to love my enemies. And I know that's not the way of the world, but I think that's Christ's way. And I think that's Christ's message to me as I can read the gospel. So I can't justify myself participating in nuclear war. I don't want to contribute to it. I don't want to pay my taxes to pay for the nuclear war. And I don't want to stand by silent while we prepare for a nuclear war. So what have I done? I've voted for people that I felt would support my opinion. I've lobbied, and I've vigiled, gone on protest, held up signs, that sort of thing. But then I felt like I had to take a further step because of my convictions. To not act is to be a hypocrite in my own eyes. So in March of last year, March 22nd, I went to a place called Bangor, Washington. Prior to that, I had gone to a retreat with some other people that were planning a nonviolent action. And we learned about nonviolence, a nonviolent response, how to react to deputies or other people that were hostile to us. Anyway, I went to Bangor with other people, where I stood and waited for the white train, this white train that carries the nuclear warheads from Pantex through the country to Bangor. And while I was there, there's a sign at Bangor, and it says, just says Bangor, just before you get to the base along the tracks. And some people had decided that they would put up a sign that says death camp, because I think they were reflecting Archbishop Hunthausen, who is the Archbishop of Seattle, his statements that Puget Sound is the Auschwitz of, or Bangor is the Puget Sound. I always get this confused. Bangor is the Auschwitz of Puget Sound, which are pretty strong words. But as a group, we felt that that sign needed to be changed because it was offensive to some people, probably would be offensive to the engineers that drove the train, the people that worked at Bangor, for us to say that it was a death camp. So we changed it to read, "We love you and we resist Trident." And that, to me, really reflects the essence of what nonviolent action is about. and what peace is about. That in order for me to act, I must act peacefully. Peacefully toward everyone involved. Toward those who oppose me in particular. Especially those who oppose me. So we waited for the train, and as it approached, we were radioed and notified that it was coming. And so the crowd became silent. And then the silence was broken by helicopters. First of all, helicopters, Navy helicopters, local TV stations that flew in order to see the action. And then we saw the light of the train. It was in the middle of the day, but it still had a light that kind of stuck with me. And I had planned to walk out in front of the train and sit down on the tracks. And as the train approached, I was waiting for the moment to start. And I was afraid that, the most of all, I was afraid for my own safety. I was afraid for what might happen. But I think I was also afraid, and I know I was afraid, that no one would do anything. That I would not take the moment and walk out in front. That the train would pass, the train carrying the warheads would pass, and no one would do anything to stop it. So I waited for what seemed a long time, but was probably only a few seconds, and then walked out and sat in front of the train as it approached. And at the time, this is hard for me to explain, but at the time that I sat in front of the train, I felt no fear, although preparing for the action, I had been, you know, as nervous as anything, just sitting in front of the train, I was completely at peace. And I feel that that was because my mind was in agreement with the action and my heart was in agreement with the action. And that, for me, I think that the Holy Spirit was with me then, too, because I wasn't in any fear. Well, I wasn't sitting on the tracks long when a Kitsap County sheriff came and told me that I'd be arrested if I didn't move, and I didn't move, so I was arrested. And I was taken to a squad car, and then we went to the courthouse and we were booked. That's fingerprints and pictures like you see on TV. And we were released that day on our personal recognizance. That is, that we agreed to show up for trial. There were five of us in the group, as well as some people that were support people. And we agreed that we would show up, that we would accept responsibility for what we had done. Because to commit an action of nonviolence, civil disobedience, is to be willing to accept what punishment might be meted out. It's not an act of anarchy, because we're not trying to break down the system of laws. We're trying to change laws, and we're trying to change the people's attitudes. After the action, we had to start preparing for the trial. We had a trial by jury about a couple months later. One of the main points that we wanted to present at the trial was a point of, we felt the train was unlawfully operated. We were charged with attempting to obstruct a lawfully operated train. But we felt that the train is illegal under international law. Robert Aldrich agreed to testify. The man I mentioned before that was helped design the system, who would testify that the system, Trident system, was indeed a first strike weapon. And Richard Falk, who is a professor of international law at Princeton University, came to testify that under international law, first strike weapons are illegal. For example, that at the International Tribunal at Nuremberg, they outlawed any aggressive weapons. They outlawed the destruction of cities and towns and villages indiscriminately. And they, the UN has since unanimously affirmed those principles. Those Nuremberg principles are the principles under which we tried the Germans for crimes against humanity and crimes against peace. And Richard Falk agreed to testify that the United States is violating those principles now. We also arranged for Archbishop Hunthausen to testify. And he would testify that acts of civil disobedience have affected his views part of our defense was to show that civil disobedience is an effective way of making policy. And Archbishop Hunthausen has decided to withhold 50% of his income taxes as a protest against the nuclear arms race. And he's also helped write the peace pastoral letter within the Catholic Church, and which has recently come out, basically against the arms race. Well, the trial was on May 19th, and at Kitsap County Courthouse. A lot of the evidence that we had prepared was not admissible. The judge ruled that it was inadmissible because it was irrelevant. That was something that we had kind of expected, because most judges and most in these circumstances try to very strictly follow precedent and maintain the status quo. It's not something that they want to have controversial material introduced, and there's a lot of other reasons. But some of the people were allowed to testify somewhat, because Gene Clark, who is one of my co-defendants, personally knew them, and they were allowed to testify to show her state of mind at the time of the crime. It was a two-day trial, and the jury went out, and they spent about 5 hours out, which was quite a long time, considering that each of us had gone on stand and admitted that we'd sat in front of the train and that we intended to do so, and that we'd probably do so again. But they came back with a verdict of guilty, and talking to one of the jury members later, Ray Kohlberg, he said that the jury really didn't have a handle on how to acquit us, to find us not guilty, because the prosecutor had summed up his arguments by saying that they had a responsibility to follow the law and strictly follow the letter of the law. So although the jury was in some way sympathetic, they didn't really have the handle to acquit us. After you have a trial, then you have to come back again later. One of the things I learned is that it takes a lot of time. So we later came back again for sentencing, and we didn't really get sentenced then, so we had to come back again after that. And we're finally sentenced to eight days in jail. The judge said that we could do community service or pay fines, but we had, as a group, decided not to accept those alternatives because we didn't believe that we had done anything wrong. And so there's no reason why we should pay fines or do community service, especially since most of us were engaged in community service types of employment anyway. So I ended up spending 8 days in Kitsap County Jail, and that was last summer. On the whole, for me, it was almost a pleasant experience in some ways, because in the mornings, we got up at about 5:45, although, you know, you get up real early, you don't have any place to go or anything to do, but that's the schedule. Then I had a lot of time to myself. I had time to read and to pray. It was a time when I felt I had the time to waste with God, to spend time. But it's not that way for most people, or it wasn't that way for most women in the jail. There were women there that were brought in the middle of the night. One woman, she had an argument with her sister, and somebody called the police. So she got hauled in, and she didn't, you know, she wasn't even sure if anybody was taking care of her kids. And two women, while I was there, just 8 days, their husbands served divorce papers on them while they're in jail. And they weren't getting the support that I was either. And they weren't in for reasons of conscience. And in addition to that, the jail is a place of no privacy, and it's cold. It was cold in the summertime because they had the air conditioner on all the time. And it's just a barren metal and concrete cell. So it's not totally a pleasant experience. Since that time, since I've gotten out of jail, my relationship with the White Train has continued. I feel I have to continue because I think I'm responsible for the train if I don't do anything, and I'm a citizen of this country. In February of this year, there was another vigil and another action. It was at night, and it was at Bangor again. There were people lit candles waiting for the train. It was a time of celebration as we waited for the train, in a way, because the fact that so many people, maybe a couple hundred people, were out there was a sign of hope. The train came, and several people sat in front of it again, and they were arrested, but the county didn't press charges against them, so they let them go. And I think it was a sign. It reminded me when Holden had an Easter service, a candlelight service, and it was similar to that, standing outside in the dark and then lighting candles and coming in to celebrate and to have Eucharist together. Because at Bangor, we also did that. We passed around bread. And if I didn't believe that there was any hope in what I was doing, then I wouldn't act. So for me, I'm acting in hope. And it's from death to life for me. It's from despair to hope. So this Sunday is Pentecost Sunday, and I'm going to a place, Bangor, Washington, where there's again another vigil, probably not a train, because we scheduled for Sunday and the government probably won't send a train through that day. And it's not an action of civil disobedience. It's simply a time for people to witness and to accept their responsibility, because I think we all have some responsibility for the train. We, you know, some people support it and some people don't, but we all have responsibility for its existence. This summer, there'll probably be another white train through, probably as early as July, maybe as late as November. The train passes through Centralia, Washington, which is my hometown. And I'm wondering now what my next response is. I'm wondering what it would be like if I was arrested in my hometown, if I was prosecuted by someone that I had babysat their kids, if I spent time in Lewis County Jail. But I feel it's a responsibility that I have to continue to accept. And I will continue to accept. I'm open to questions or comments, suggestions. What should I do?
Did that train go to Portland?
Yes. It was stopped in Portland in February for several hours. This fellowship has some pictures of the Portland action. Sojourners has some pictures of our action. Yeah.
I'd be interested in how far you're personally willing to take this, because I would imagine each time you're arrested, the sentence might get worse.
That's a question I could answer now, but I think I have to wait and see to really know. Hopefully, you know, if I'm really committed, then it doesn't matter what the sentence is.
Why do you think the second group of people who examined the tracks were not sentenced?
I don't think that second group was sentenced because there were a lot of clergy involved in the action, and because the first action got a lot of publicity. And the county was trying to avoid that the second time around. It's hard to say what they'll do the next time.
For your action on Sunday, will there be press?
I don't know. It's been advanced ahead of time, so there won't be any actions of civil disobedience. So. It's hard to say.
Has the government made any public statement, if there were any statements about actions or anybody else's actions?
The only public statement the government has made is to propose a law that it be a felony to pass on any information about the white train's whereabouts or its schedule, and that would be punishable by 10 years in jail and $20,000 fine, either or. So that's the statement.
Karen, who's that statement to not pass on any? Who has that information, I think?
Well, people find out where the train is by watching for it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a woman in Texas that has a place by the tracks and watches for the train, and then she calls down the line. There's a whole network of people all around the country.
Okay, so what she's doing then as a citizen is technically illegal.
Right, that's illegal. Okay. It's illegal if I see it and I tell you it's coming. It's not illegal yet. This is a proposed.
Oh. Law.
Does a train take the same route all the time?
Or? No, the route does differ some. I pinned up a map over there. Maybe take a look afterwards. The train now avoids the state of Colorado because there have been a lot of protests in that area, and the governor has spoken out against it.
What kind of impact do you think you have on people that don't agree with you, like sheriffs or people who are in the military industry? Have you had any dialogue with those people, or how do you assess that?
Ground Zero has a regular, for one thing, they have a regular schedule of leafleting at the Puget Sound Naval Shipyards, which is where they work on the submarines, so that it's a continuing dialogue. At least three people that I can think of offhand have resigned from their jobs there, partially as a result of leafleting and civil disobedience. Those are some of the actions. I think of a story that happened shortly after I was arrested. I was at a dinner at someone's house, and this subject came up, and a man told me that he heard it on the radio, and he hoped that when he heard it, he thought, well, I hope they just get run over. And then I said, well, I was one of those people that was sitting there. And, you know, that makes him have a different reaction. And I think that, you know, that does, that as an individual, that changes reactions.
Were there any other actions along the tracks at the same time?
Really? Right. There were a number of other actions. I don't know. I think, I don't know how many. I think Colorado, maybe some, Idaho. And this past time the train came by, there were even more actions. And a lot of places where there aren't, where people don't break the law, but simply witness to the passing of the train. Sojourners has some good articles about that, and so does, let's see, I have this, Ground Zero, the newspaper. They have a lot of articles on the White Train and the Trident submarine. Sure.
How do you see a defensive weapon as over against an offensive weapon? What's the difference?
Well,
it's only when it's used, isn't it?
Yeah, to some extent. Although an offensive weapon has different capabilities. And the Trident submarine has the ability, the Trident missiles have the ability to destroy hardened missile silos. And they're accurate enough so that they can strike within about 30 feet. There's no point in destroying empty missile silos. So Robert Aldrich has concluded that the point of those missiles is to destroy the Soviet missiles while they're in their silos. And there's a lot of other information I could give you on that, but that's one point. And also, well, our policy seems to have drifted towards not saying that we would use our weapons as first strike, but not saying that we won't either.
Were there protests were there protests at point of origin of the train, where the train started?
No, it's pretty hard to do because it's hard to organize it. The only way we know when it leaves is when it leaves. There's no advance notice, yeah.
Hasn't the Bishop of Amarillo also been involved?
Bishop Matheson, I think his name is, has spoken out against the arms race, and I believe they're also trying to set up a fund for those people that decide to quit their jobs that are nuclear industry related, so that those people would have something to fall back on. And I think there was a question back here.
Yes, just wanted to say that. In 1978, my son entered the service. He was 18. And he entered the naval service to be on crew of a submarine. And so last year on the date of your trial, I think he said it's May 19th.
Mm-hmm.
He was 23. He was at Bangor, Washington. It's been rather difficult for him, I believe. He's been pressured to re-enlist if he would, but he doesn't really enjoy it that much. It isn't something that he really wants to do in his life. But anyway, it's been his 6 years. And to be on a Triton, he'd have to re-enlist, which he doesn't like the sound of. But at any rate, he wants to get out. And when you're in college, you become an engineer.
Pardon?
This is not a Triton summary.
Yeah, I understand.
When he told that, the young man, I what they would be, that was fellow. Seeing himself very young and like the boy next door, the young cook said to me, I think I know what a mother must feel like in protesting. The nuclear arms race, so they have very meaningful discussions.
That's difficult, and I know that people on the submarines, even if it's a good job to be in the Navy and you have a good pension, and it takes quite a you have to really believe that it's wrong in order to quit, and that's something I haven't been faced with. I haven't worked there.
So. I'm interested in the group that you're in. How did you find out about it? How do you get involved?
I'm not actually in a group. I work through Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, and that's organized by Jim Douglas and Shelley Douglas. There are different groups around the country. I think Lutheran Peace Fellowship would probably be a good place to write to. And I think their address is on the bulletin board in the dining room. And the Resource Center has a lot of information.
Also, Fellowship of Reconciliation has a whole newsletter on the White Train. They publish an ad and saying where a protest is and how you can help people reach points from the Christian home.
And if you want addresses of any of those, you can talk to me afterwards.
How does it feel to see the White Train? I'm thinking everything I know about nuclear weapons is by chart, statistics, books. You're one step, I'm one step removed, I look at all the charts and the map of megatons, all of this, but I'm just imagining seeing this white train just slowly going across our country filled with weapons that are designed to threaten to kill millions of people. Does it give it a much more sense of reality?
Yeah. The first time I saw it, it didn't so much because I was thinking of sitting in front of it. But the next time, it's a concrete symbol. It's more than a symbol. It's concrete. It shows me what the arms race is. And it's awesome to see all the security. There are military or Marines waiting in the bushes. And to see if there's any problems, and FBI agents and police, and that makes me realize how massive it is, and it makes me angry to see it too, to know that it continues.
Is it a long train?
It varies in length, maybe 12 or 15 cars. Not real long.
The railroad tracks they travel. Can other trains go on that track?
Same track as any train.
Well, they could easily have an accident.
That's possible, yeah.
Didn't they have an accident one time in White Train someplace around in Oregon or someplace in there? It went off the track. My sister wrote to me about it. That's quite a few years ago.
I don't know about that.
Is there like one warhead per car? And how big is a warhead?
I don't know how many warheads per car there are, no. I can't tell you that.
Do they have nice padding?
I've never seen inside. That's really, even to know how many warheads is an assumption. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
just a regular box car, isn't it?
Well, it looks different. It's white.
Oh,
and there's and they're labeled ATMX in black letters, which stands for Atomic Energy Commission, and the F stands means indicates that there's no railroad that owns the cars. They're pulled by a regular engine. When it comes to Bangor, they're pulled by Burlington Northern. So we've done a lot of leafleting in Burlington Northern too, in Seattle.
Where do they go when they arrive at their destination?
Well, they come to Bangor, they go to the naval base, they go to Swift Pac, which is where they unload the weapons, where they have the bunkers for the warheads. It's deep inside the heart of the base.
Can you prove that there is a weapon in the plane, or how do you know?
Probably, one is the security. Two, the government neither confirms nor denies that they're weapons. Three, Jim Douglas, when he first saw the train, researched it, and looking at documents from Washington State Utilities Commission, found that the letters between them and between the base indicated that if they had to transport nuclear weapons, well, they'd use a white train, and there would be letters on them, ATMX, and that matches the description of the train.
There must be a part missing. They would be definitely.
No, that's, it's not the total. That you're correct. There are parts missing.
Karen, it seems to me that there are many acts of conscience or civil disobedience that a person could do, but to sit down in front of a moving train immediately so that you were perhaps ready to die at that moment, you, I don't know exactly what I'm asking, but do you feel like that was true or?
Well, as a group, we had discussed that because there are dangers involved in sitting in front of a moving train. I hadn't really resolved the issue when I sat in front of the train. But as the train approached, like I say, I was at peace, and I wasn't watching the train. I was looking at my feet, and I can't say for sure what I would have done. But I don't think at that time that I was inclined to move.
Did he have you off the track before the train came?
Yeah. Or I probably wouldn't be here.
It didn't have to stop.
No, it didn't stop.
You think it could stop in time? I mean, if it wouldn't kill you? I don't think so.
Well.
And maybe you wouldn't care. I don't care.
Well, if I did, I would care.
There'd be an awful lot of publicity if they ever killed someone.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not rather true. You should go to the source of where the train came from. I mean, where they loaded it or where they're making the warhead.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that sounds more practical.
That's another possibility, sure.
It's it seems to me though that you almost have to ask where you are. It's often hard sometimes to go far away, and if you're able to act where you are, it seems to me that that would be a practical thing to take your stand right there.
Mm-hmm.
I also think, in my opinion, I would really guess that the government would not really have any intention of having anyone killed,
mm-hmm.
but I think accidents could also happen just like a missile could be launched
mm-hmm.
in the air.
Chris?
Within our system of government, there are channels, I think, that we are able to use to maybe change some law that we don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's happening sometimes tonight is that people aren't hearing the channels that maybe you pursued before
mm-hmm.
you went and sat in front of the chain,
mm-hmm.
the train. And if you could maybe fill up a little bit about what you did through normal channels before you went to this other step,
mm-hmm.
that might be helpful.
I have supported people that are, you know, like Congress people that are opposed to nuclear weapons. I didn't vote for Ronald Reagan. I've written letters. I've written to Ronald Reagan. I've done what I felt I could in the normal channels. And other people have done what they could. But it's also, when we're talking about nuclear war, we're talking about something that could happen at any time. And massive destruction. And I think it calls for unusual actions, out of the ordinary actions at least on some people's parts. But I think there's a lot of different ways to respond to nuclear war.
How do you feel about the Russian statement to the effect that they have now lined up a whole bunch of subs on our Atlantic coast because they were sending these missiles over to Europe?
Mm-hmm.
Does that bother you? Aren't they theirs any good?
Pardon?
Aren't theirs any good?
They aren't as good as ours. I haven't heard the statement. I can say that if the Russians were to start a nuclear war, I think that would be wrong. And I think it would be wrong if the U.S. started a nuclear war. But since I live in the U.S., I'll do what I can to prevent the U.S. And I think as a Christian, especially, I'll do what I can to prevent that from happening. I don't know what time it's getting. Maybe somebody... Okay, maybe we could have just a couple more comments. Or how about that there?
I'm probably sitting on the other side of the tracks with you. I sympathize with you. I was one of those who slept by missiles. I was served in a Negro submarine of my own choice. I asked to be on it. I was very proud to be on it. I was also one of those who got up every morning and watched little lights going on all 16 missiles, checking that they should have functioned. At the time, I was 19, and I felt like I was doing something that people in World War I had done, people in World War II had done, that people in Korea had done. And somehow I had to take responsibility that a lot of us don't like to take. Responsibility to make sure this land is free so I can get the car and drive across the country so that my children can walk outside. So I can come to a place like this and listen to other people talk about how they feel and how they don't feel. I stayed in that force for 3 months. Every morning I got up, and I was very much aware of what those missiles could do. I was very much aware of how many little buildings we had on the top and where they were directed to and their potential. At the same time, I was aware of the Russian submarines that were tailing us. Daisy chains, they call them. Submarine after submarine after submarine. And it's a big game. Now, the 16 potential missiles we had, I know for sure that 4 were empty. I think a lot of the these white trains that go by, you'd be surprised at how few are actually in there. You'd be surprised how few actual missiles are loaded into the silos in the submarines, and how many go out to sea with a lot less than we expect them to be going out with. Simply because we know the potential that we have with 6 of those Trident missiles, mm-hmm. much less having put 24 in. We can get everything we don't want done with 10. We've got 20 independent MIRVs on top that can drop 20, nuclear bombs from their missiles wherever they wanted to go. I chose to leave after those 3 months of being on it. The submarine force is supposedly the cream of the crop of the Navy, and I never met one individual who sat beside me at those missiles controls saying that I just don't know what I would do if someone said to lift that latch and push that button. Because every day we go through the same thing under the water while people above are going through the same thing. We're very much aware of the destructive power, but call it patriotism or call it whatever you'd like to call it, there's a real sense in the submarine force that we're out there, and because we're out there, this land stays free. Because the reality of it is, we can talk about sitting across the table with the Russians and talking to our faces are blue and dialoguing, which I'm all for, but history repeats itself. Russia's leaders have made very clear their intention right from the very beginning 60 years ago, and they haven't changed one bit. The Russian people, I think, feel much the same as many of us do. They're disgusted with it, but they have less potential for doing anything about it. I don't think the Russians want nuclear war any more than we do because there's no one to win it. And I admire what you do. I know for a fact that if there wasn't anyone there in front of you pulling you out of there, that the train would run over you. The orders are very strict, and that's the reason Marines are around there, because the big thing now is terrorists. We don't think about that, but one nuclear weapon with a terrorist, God knows where, that can start the whole chain reaction. And I admire what you do. I can sympathize to some point, but I'm really glad that I know some people that are out there right now. Her son, for one, who have the same feeling with the same intensity that people are walking free in this land because the Russians know that.
Mm-hmm.
We have a balance there. And as far as this unilateral disarmament and just kind of throwing our weapons down, I think the day that happens is the day when you take your choice, you would be ready to be dead.
I was listening to a head person of the Honeywell Company in Minneapolis over KCCM, a Minnesota Public Radio program. And they were having a discussion like this in a forum, but the one that I was impressed with was the journalist who had covered the Vietnam War and had really gone through. He said he would never, ever want to go through what he had gone through. And he said, I don't want my son to go through that. And he said, I have four sons. And when there is a war, my four sons will have to go. But he said, I want my United States to defend my four sons and my family and the rest. And he said, I am not for a nuclear weapon, but I do want my country to defend it. And he said, we don't want to be first, Russia doesn't want to be first, but this nuclear weapon is to keep us from either one starting. And I thought that was stupid.
I want to thank everybody for coming. I guess I'd just like to conclude by saying that my belief is that it's more important for me to act as a Christian than to act as an American citizen. And if that means that the United States should fall, then the United States would fall. And I would act as a Christian in solidarity with other Christians in Russia and Eastern Europe, Western Europe, in attempting to live out the message of the gospel. If anybody has any other comments, maybe you can talk to me afterwards. Thanks.
Thank you.